At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
We are going to talk about tax reform for 5 minutes and 48 seconds on this program today. And you know what? It is going to be awesome. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, the 3rd of August. Glad as always to have you with us, everybody. Tax reform coming up. But first, let's set aside for a second, shall we? Discussions of what language people coming to this country ought to speak and what that poem says on the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty. And while acknowledging the emotional realities of the immigration debate, get down to economic brass tacks. President Trump, as you know, has thrown his weight behind a bill that would fundamentally change American immigration policy. Number one, it would be skills-based, assuming the thing passes. And number two, it would cut in half the number of people legally allowed to come here. Put another way, this is a story about making the labor force smaller in an economy already pretty near full employment. Marketplace's Adrian Hill gets us going.
Most economists will tell you immigration is, on whole, good for the economy. Cutting the number of immigrants allowed in?
I think it actually goes in just the opposite direction of what we need.
John McLaren is an economics professor at the University of Virginia. If you take a look around the country, employers in the agriculture industry, the tourism industry, they say they're having trouble finding enough people to work.
We need to make it feasible for employers who need immigrant workers to hire the workers legally.
Cutting immigration also isn't going to help the president reach the 3% GDP growth his budget and tax proposals depend on. In fact, it's likely to do the opposite. Most economists will tell you immigration boosts economic growth. Kirk Doran is an economics professor at the University of Notre Dame.
Generally, if you look at economic models, when people interact with each other, good stuff happens.
Immigrants add to the labor supply. They create businesses. They consume. In the long run, says Doran, all that economic activity is a plus. But
the long run can take a long time for some segments of the population.
And the upsides aren't evenly distributed. Chad Sparber is an economics professor at Colgate University.
It's certainly true that some Americans are hurt by immigration.
Americans competing for manual labor-intensive jobs, for example.
If we see Americans who are suffering as a result of immigration, I wish we could think more about ways to help those individuals.
And less, he says, about policies that shut down our borders. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
The White House might have other plans, but leaders in both houses of Congress seem bound and determined to put health care behind them and move on to tax reform. Various and sundry interest groups have made it clear that's what they want to do as well, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Neil Bradley is the Senior Vice President and Chief Policy Officer at the Chamber. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai. It's a pleasure to be here.
There has been a sliding timeline of when the White House is hoping to get tax reform done by. The latest, I think, was from Secretary Mnuchin the other day. He said November is when he wants it passed the Senate. How realistic do you think that is?
Well, you know, it may slip a little bit past November. You know, it's good to set deadlines, even if sometimes you don't hit them. But we're at least appreciative of the sense of urgency that the secretary's displaying.
Your boss, the president and CEO of the chamber, Tom Donahue, wrote an open letter to members of Congress like 10 days ago in which he basically said, well, not basically, he flat out said, get tax reform done or else. What's the or else?
Well, what he said is that failure is not an option, and that when it comes to evaluating candidates who the chamber is going to support for public office, one of the things that we're going to take into consideration is did they contribute to helping tax reform get across the finish line, or did they stand in the way? You know, a candidate, elected official who's standing in the way of tax reform is not someone who's looking out for American families or the economy.
You're going to campaign against them? Is that what I hear you saying?
Well, it's going to be a consideration. And, you know, we've scored members of Congress based on their votes for about 40 years now. And that goes into a consideration of who we endorse and who we support and who we work against. But an overarching factor this time is going to be tax reform. And did they help us get it done?
He said in this letter, Mr. Donahue did, he said, quote, "We will be focusing on individuals with a demonstrated willingness to govern, which means reaching consensus so that legislation can be passed and enacted into law." That sounds like you're saying you guys got a compromise.
That's exactly what we're saying. We got a lot of folks who give lip service to what they're for. And if only everyone else would agree with them, it would get done. That's not the way the legislative process works. Everyone's got to give and take. We're willing to give and take as part of the business community. We know that our perfect bill is not going to become law, but we want to see something happen here. And if we're willing to compromise, members of Congress need to be willing to compromise as well.
Where does this go economically if the Congress cannot get its act together? I mean, you guys in this letter, Mr. Donahue in this letter was harsh about the party with which the chamber has been traditionally aligned.
I think your first question is the real important point. What happens economically if we don't get this done? We've had a decade of basically 2% growth. That's never happened before in modern American history. You know, Americans since World War II are used to, you know, 3% plus growth. That's 50% bigger economic growth than what we've experienced the last decade. There is no way, in our opinion, that we're going to get back to the levels of economic growth that we all want minus tax reform. So that's why it's so important. That's why there have to be consequences if it doesn't get done.
I'm glad you mentioned that 2 and 3% growth thing. Mick Mulvaney, as you know, the director of the OMB, has been very vocal about his desire, about the president's desire to get to 3% economic growth. Tax reform can't do it by itself, as much as the chamber may want to think so. What else has to happen for the Trump administration to get its economic agenda in gear?
Well, we actually would agree with that. Tax reform alone won't get it done. You do have to have regulatory reform. You have to have pro-growth trade policies. You know, we have to deal with our cybersecurity threats. But if we did everything else right and we didn't get tax reform done, we're not going to get to the economic growth that we all want to see. So tax reform is kind of the indispensable element. It's not enough by itself, but if you did everything else and didn't do tax reform, we're going to end up falling short.
Why is tax reform the thing in y'all's mind?
Well, because we have the most uncompetitive tax code in the industrialized world. We tax our businesses at the highest rate. We're one of the only countries in the world that continues to tax businesses both at home and abroad, this sense of kind of double taxation. Our small businesses have one of the highest tax rates in the world as well. It's just a system that's punishing to those who want to grow their business or start a new one. So it's been 31 years since we last reformed the tax code. The rest of the world's passed us by in those three decades, and it's having real consequences for businesses and for workers and for families.
The catch, of course, is the last time we did tax reform and gave corporations a break on repatriated taxes and all of those things, companies didn't actually pass it down to workers, right? They did stock buybacks and handed out dividends to shareholders. It didn't get out through the economy.
Well, I think what you're pointing to is the reason that we need broad, comprehensive tax reform. That, you know, that was a one-off scenario for a temporary break to repatriate funds into the U.S. And we shouldn't be surprised if people don't make permanent decisions based on very temporary tax relief measures. That's why you have to reform the whole system. If you want a business to invest in a new factory in America, if you want them to hire new workers, very difficult for a business to do that when what the government says, well, we'll give you a tax break for a couple years, but then we're going to take it away from you. If you can give me the certainty of what the government's going to be doing on taxes for the long term, then I have the freedom to invest and to grow the business without having to worry about Uncle Sam.
Neil Bradley, he's the Senior Vice President and Chief Policy Officer at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Neil, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai. It's been a pleasure.
Told you. Awesome, right? Little hiccup on Wall Street today after news broke that special counsel Robert Mueller has impaneled a grand jury, but mostly traders didn't give a fig. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A little bit more than 9 years ago, May of 2008, Postville, Iowa, population as of the most recent census, 2,116, was the scene of one of the biggest workplace immigration raids this country's ever seen. Nearly 400 undocumented workers were rounded up at the kosher meatpacking plant there. It's called Agriprocessors. That plant shut down about 5 months later. The company filed for bankruptcy, and the whole town found itself deep in crisis. Marketplace's Annie Baxter went to northern Iowa to see what's happened since.
In 2008, school kids in Postville heard helicopters circling over their school. Pedro Lopez Vega was in seventh grade at the time. He and his buddies looked out the window and wondered what was going on.
What we were thinking was maybe they're the National Guard trying to show off to the high schoolers, try and recruit a couple of them or something like that. Like they're giving them helicopter rides or, you know, whatever.
Lopez's parents worked at the kosher meatpacking plant in town, Agriprocessors. He and most of his family, immigrants from Mexico, were undocumented. Fear about being deported was always in the background, so the helicopters triggered that, too.
Because then there's also that kind of voice in the back of your head. What if the biggest fear of your life, you know, the thing that can essentially destroy your life, is happening?
He asked teachers what was going on. They didn't know at first. Then a friend confirmed his fear. It was a raid at Agriprocessors. Lopez's dad wasn't working that shift, but he knew his mom was.
I went to my desk, put my head down, started crying. I was like, that's it. That's my mom.
His mom was one of nearly 400 undocumented workers rounded up in the raid. She told authorities she was in the country alone so that Lopez, his dad, and two sisters wouldn't be discovered. Over the following year, his mom was shipped to multiple detention centers in several states. She was eventually deported back to Mexico. For Lopez, the separation was brutal emotionally. And without his mom's income, the family sometimes couldn't pay its water bills. They started to go to the local food pantry. The raid affected more than undocumented families.
It cratered the Northeast Iowa economy, and a lot of innocent people got really hurt.
Aaron Goldsmith has lived in Postville 20 years and owns a local medical supply company. He's part of the Hasidic Jewish community that sprang up in Postville around the kosher meat plant. He says because of the raid, hundreds of undocumented workers disappeared practically overnight, no longer paying rent, no longer spending money around town. This all happened as the Great Recession was unfolding.
We had, you know, so many houses foreclosed on, people abandoned their houses, businesses just picked up and walked away. See, on the corner of the street, we had a big, huge Hispanic grocery store and restaurant. That building's still empty.
And so that was the raid, not just the recession.
100% the raid. 100% the raid drove that out.
Goldsmith had a hard time financing an expansion of his own business because property values dropped so sharply. Several agriprocessor managers wound up in prison for labor and immigration violations, along with financial crimes. New owners bought the kosher plant nearly a year after the raid. It got a new name, AgriStar. They eventually tapped a new source of workers with legal status, Somali refugees. Goldsmith, who's ever the town booster, points out once empty storefronts that are now Somali-owned businesses. One of them is next to a synagogue.
That's the ultimate diversity. You know, I consider the Middle East how broken it is. And here you have, you know, a Muslim Somali business right next to an Orthodox Jewish synagogue.
But the long-term prospects for Postville, like most rural towns its size, are not great. The population is aging. The workforce is shrinking. Which is why some folks in town say there are business owners that still rely on undocumented workers 9 years after the raid. Pedro Lopez Vega's family no longer counts among them.
We all have permanent residency right now.
Visas, then green cards. His mom returned from Mexico. Lopez just finished college and moved to the Minneapolis suburbs. His parents still live in Postville. And for work?
Both of them work at AgriStar.
Even with new owners, it is the same place where his mom got arrested. But Lopez isn't shocked she went back.
Tell me another place that they can work at in Postville. Tell me another small town that they feel comfortable living in.
Despite everything that happened in Postville, Lopez says it's safe. It's quiet. It's home. In Postville, Iowa, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Businesses aren't maybe offering what they should be in today's market.
Yeah, maybe. Low inflation, workers' wages, and the paradox of full employment. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 9 today, less than a 10th percent, closed at 22,026. That, by definition, is another record high. NASDAQ dipped 22 points, about 3-tenths percent, 63.40. S&P 500 down 5, 2-tenths percent, 24.72. Avon CEO Sherilyn McCoy is out. She was a target of activist investors who wanted new leadership. They will now get it. Cosmetics company also posted a loss for the second quarter. Avon shares not so pretty, down 10.7%. After reaching a high this week, Apple shares felt the bite today, down 9-tenths percent. Tesla charged up 6.5% today after its earnings beat expectations. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.22%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity. A how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The holiday shopping season is probably the very last thing you want to think about here at the beginning of August, with temperatures in the triple digits in some parts of the country. Lucky for you, then, that you are probably not running a giant package delivery company. FedEx announced today it is not going to be adding surcharges to regular holiday deliveries this year. That's interesting because a couple of months ago, rival UPS said it is going to be adding an extra 27 cents to all of its ground transported packages over the same period. Marketplace Jed Kim gets us up to speed on the holiday shipping battle.
Rivalry is one thing, but the real battle is against the massive onslaught of packages both companies have to get to their destinations all within a couple weeks. Dave Ross manages logistics research at Stiefel. He says it makes sense to charge more then.
It's extremely stressful, time-consuming, capital-consuming. That should be when you make the most money, because it's the period that costs you the most money.
That's why UPS says it'll add a small surcharge to all ground-shipped packages during Crazy Pants time. FedEx, though, says it'll leave most shipping alone. Is this to be more competitive? Patrick Fitzgerald is a FedEx spokesman.
We don't view it that way. We view it as setting appropriate prices for our customers for the service that we provide.
UPS declined to give an interview, saying it doesn't comment on competitors' actions. Satish Jindal is president of Ship Matrix, which provides consulting on logistics. He says FedEx's pricing scheme reflects its ability to absorb peak crush better, relying on a large network of independent contractors.
They have 1,000+ who manage how they add capacity during the peak time to support their business, as opposed to one company, UPS, doing it for all its locations.
FedEx will, however, tack an additional $25 cost onto oversized packages.
Large televisions or furniture or mattresses, things that can't be automated in the sortation.
FedEx's Fitzgerald says shipping of oversized items has increased by 240% in the past decade. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
It's no secret that the Republican Party has had some internal disagreements. Yes, the Dems do too, but it's the GOP that's in power, right? We saw that divide most clearly in the healthcare debate, but there is another example more directly market
oriented. The intra-party indecision over what to do about the Export-Import Bank, a government agency that provides financing to facilitate U.S. exports. That's the official line. Loans and loan guarantees is what it really is to foreign businesses and governments so that they can buy American. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
Here's how libertarians feel about the Export-Import Bank.
I think it's a nice example of corporate welfare.
That's Matthew Mitchell of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He says the Export-Import Bank only benefits huge U.S. corporations, which really don't need the help. He says Congress should kill off the bank. Oddly enough, the man President Trump has nominated to head the bank, former Republican Congressman Scott Garrett, thinks the same thing. Mitchell says his nomination is the latest front in the Republican Party's civil war.
It is in many ways a proxy war for the debate within the conservative side of the aisle on the proper role of government.
That spilled over into the intense debate over whether the Senate should confirm Garrett as the bank's new president. Business groups that support the bank are working overtime to oppose Garrett.
This probably takes up about a third of my time.
Dan Storr is a spokesman for the Aerospace Industries Association, which represents the defense, aerospace, and aviation industries, U.S. businesses that make expensive stuff they want to export to international clients who couldn't afford their products without an Export-Import Bank loan or loan guarantee.
It's very important. It's a competitive tool.
Storr says if Garrett is confirmed, he'd set the agenda for the bank. Peter Cohn of Height Securities says that would give Garrett some power.
In terms of what particular deals get more scrutiny than others and what, you know, potentially imposing some more onerous terms.
But Cohn says it's not clear whether Garrett would work to stop deals and kill the bank or just slow things down and try to reform it. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
We talked up at the top of the program about the prospect of cutting legal immigration to this country at a time when the unemployment rate's about as low as it's ever been. The July jobs report comes out tomorrow morning, by the way. But that growing labor shortage is what employers in this economy, from manufacturers to small businesses to technology firms, are talking about. So we sent Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman out to Bend, Oregon, to see how it's working out in real life.
Bend is at the foothills of the Cascade Mountains in central Oregon, and the city is booming. Technology workers and retirees are moving to town. Since 2010, the population's grown 20%, which means a lot of new houses, roads, and utility ditches. And that's good for Todd Taylor's family-owned construction firm. He's got about 150 employees. He's always looking to hire a few more, though
there's a labor shortage.
That's a big reversal from 2008 after the housing crash.
Looking back, although it was challenging, there was plenty of good people that were in transition of jobs, and we were buying equipment at 25 to 50 cents on the dollar.
He says during the downturn, a lot of construction workers left.
Moved to North Dakota in the oil fields. I would say in the last 3 or 4 years, a good portion of those people have been back.
Not enough, though, to meet employers' needs. Local unemployment's at 3.9%. Greg Lambert runs Mid-Oregon Personnel, a staffing firm. He says decades ago, this area was depressed, with timber mills closing down and working families hurting.
Now we spend thousands of dollars in recruitment costs a month, and we can't find enough people to fill our interview sheets.
He's got open positions in manufacturing, office work, hospitality at $12 to $13 an hour, well above the local minimum wage of $10.25, but
we have people routinely tell us that if you can't pay me $15 an hour plus benefits to start, I can't afford to get off my subsidies and go to work.
By subsidies, he means government benefits, like unemployment insurance and disability. Oregon regional economist Damon Runberg thinks there's another reason some employers can't find workers.
Businesses aren't maybe offering what they should be in today's market.
Greg Lambert counters that many employers can't raise prices much on their customers in order to raise pay because they'll price themselves out of the market. But UC Berkeley labor economist Jesse Rothstein says with unemployment so low, most will have to in the end.
Employers got used to paying low wages because they had so many years of excess labor.
right now what they're seeing is they can't find workers for those low wages.
One longer-term solution, expand the labor force by tapping into demographic groups that have been left out.
Individuals with disabilities, with criminal history, that are receiving food stamps.
Heather Ficht at Central Oregon's Workforce Investment Board is developing programs to boost job skills and
also working with businesses to understand that there are minor accommodations that they can make to really activate that population.
But for job seekers with marketable skills in education and a consistent work history, it's pretty much a seller's market. And remember Todd Taylor, who said folks have been coming back from North Dakota? That's construction worker Ron Marinello's story.
I was a supervisor in the oil field.
Does it look like it'll be promising here?
Oh, yeah. I could have a job tomorrow. There's so much out there, it's almost overwhelming. Anything from construction work to administrative. There's a lot of technical stuff going on.
He thinks he'll make decent money, above $25 an hour.
It's competitive for not having to tolerate the oil field.
What's so bad about the oil fields in North Dakota?
Oh my God, how much time do you have? Just the weather, the environment.
Marinello's happy to be home, but he says even with good hourly wages, he'll be strapped for cash in Bend, where housing and other living costs have soared in the continuing economic boom. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, Financial Crisis Anniversary Edition. Say what you will about Jim Cramer, the Wall Street analyst, stock picker, and former hedge fund guy so famously handed his rear end by Jon Stewart a couple of years ago. But Cramer has been around a while. He's seen some things, including, in a way, how bad the financial crisis was going to get. Today is the 10th anniversary of one of the all-time great live television meltdowns ever. Cramer on CNBC ranting, you have to say, about how then-Chairman Ben Bernanke and the rest of the Fed governors had their heads in the sand.
He has no idea.
Cramer.
I have talked to the heads of almost every single one of these firms in the last 72 hours, and he has no idea what it's like out there. None. And Bill Poole has no idea what it's like out there. My people have been in this game for 25 years, and they are losing their jobs, and these firms are going to go out of business, and he's nuts. They're nuts. They know nothing.
I met him once, Cramer. He's actually not a bad guy. He's a little excitable. Not a bad guy. March next year, for what it's worth, is 10 years since Bear Stearns. All right, that's it. We are leaving. The Dow up 9 today, less than a tenth percent. NASDAQ down 22, 3/10%. S&P 500 off 5/2%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Troh are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor for, like, what, another couple of weeks is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.